Neo Catskill. From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition, and I'm your host, Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. We've got a lot of news to get to, including an update on the drones. Maybe you've heard about the drones. And also the discovery of mastodon fossils in the Hudson Valley. Those stories and more are coming up because those are the stories that are being talked about. The Times Union, from Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau. Once again, it's Philip Pantuso to go over the news. Philip, welcome back to the Local Edition.
Always good to be with you.
I'm excited to get to the drones. But first, you've got a story about protesters involved with a pro-Palestinian encampment at SUNY New Paltz back in May are they filing a lawsuit against the SUNY system, or is it against SUNY New Paltz, and what's it all about?
Yeah, so this was a lawsuit filed by six named plaintiffs who were members of that pro-Palestinian encampment, a sort of multi-day protest there that was forcibly broken up by police, one of several protests on college campuses in the spring semester against the bombing in Gaza. They are seeking class action status, so they're seeking to sort of be representative of the 132, I think it was, people who are arrested in that breakup. And they're suing, the defendants in the case are the president of SUNY New Paltz, Daryl Wheeler, a handful of state police officers and sheriffs, and the Ulster County Sheriff himself, Juan Figueroa. But somewhat interestingly, they're also seeking the court to designate the defendants as a class unto themselves. So to represent essentially the various law enforcement agencies who they allege were acting under uniform directions and committed the same violations of constitutional rights. So just so listeners are aware, like a class action lawsuit, in order to proceed as a class action, a judge has to actually decide that the people seeking class action status are indeed representative of the class of people they're claiming to represent. It's not exactly right to call this a class action lawsuit just yet, but that's certainly what they're seeking. And it's also, I think, to me anyway, interesting that they're seeking to sue the college and these law enforcement agencies as a class unto themselves as well.
Well, that's the thing. So is that two designations of class to make it a class action lawsuit? I'm getting a little confused there. Are both sides of this need to be certified that?
Both sides need the certification. Yeah. Typically in a class action lawsuit, it's just the plaintiffs, right? You'll have, a handful of named plaintiffs who represent, a class of people who have been allegedly infringed upon in some way, and they're suing an organization or a powerful person or an institution or whatever. In this case, the defendants are named and they're representatives of, but they're named as representatives of the institutions they're from. And the people who are doing the lawsuit and their attorney are seeking to have those people also be designated as representatives of those institutions.
And have you talked to anybody for any kind of legal analysis or reaction to any of these strategies or the suit itself? Do we know what people are saying about this?
This appears to be, we did a little bit of research and, while there were several of these pro-Palestinian encampments and that were broken up by police, this appears to be the first one that is at least seeking to be a class action lawsuit. There have been a couple of other lawsuits filed by individuals who were arrested at Ohio State and at UCLA, but none that have proceeded as a class action. I would be surprised if this goes to trial. that's what they're seeking. They're seeking a jury trial and $20 million in damages. And they allege all kinds of things, basically. Alleged mistreatment by the police, including being jabbed with batons, having airsoft rifles pointed at them. There's one of the plaintiffs who alleges that she was essentially sexually assaulted, like inappropriate touching of private parts by a police officer. Another student says that she was thrown to the ground. An officer pressed his boot into her back and ripped her clothes. And there were several alleged injuries that protesters suffered at the hands of the police that are detailed in the lawsuit.
And is there anything about, and I'm just, maybe you can remind me of what actually happened, but I felt like this was all happening in May, which is graduation time at universities. I remember that being part of the question of, will this be resolved ahead of that? Is there any part of the suit related to what happened to the students in the academic year related to the protest and graduation?
No, nothing about graduation. It's really focused on what happened the night that the police came and then the immediate aftermath. So they say, that they had lost valuable property, including laptops, cell phones, books, medicines, and other materials when the encampment site was swept by police early Friday morning after the arrest, and that many of those items were not able to be retrieved. They also say that while they were awaiting processing, everybody was charged with trespassing. While they were awaiting processing, police denied them water and bathroom access and engaged in alleged dehumanizing and mocking behavior. So it's really narrowly focused on the sort of 24-hour period where the encampment was broken up and their charges were processed.
Okay. All right. And when do we expect any kind of next steps in this case?
It's going to probably move pretty slowly because we're here at the end of the year. This case was actually filed initially on December 5th, and then an amended complaint was filed earlier this week. It's a federal case. I should note that it's filed in U.S. District Court for the Northern District of New York, which is that federal courthouse up in Albany. I think there's a bunch of kind of like legal stuff that has to happen on the front end, including the designation of class status. Meanwhile, I think that there will probably be attempts made by both sides to reach a resolution out of court. At the moment, neither side is saying all that much right now. We spoke to the attorney for the plaintiffs who basically said that, like, here's what they're seeking, and they hope to take it to trial, but, they're not going to have any further comment right now. And the Ulster County Sheriff and the state police did not return a request for comment. They usually don't comment on pending litigation. And the university, SUNY New Paltz, really just said that they are aware of the lawsuit and they intend to defend our position vigorously, but they didn't make any specific comments on any of the allegations in the lawsuit itself.
Okay, well, thank you, and we'll be hearing more about it as it progresses. I wonder what will be happening around graduation time this year. We'll find out.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, you've got a brief update. This is the Megan McDonald case. Just want to real quick remind people what this is and then what the latest is.
Yeah, so Megan McDonald, she was a teenager in the Middletown area in Orange County. She was found murdered in 2003, and it was a major story at the time, but police never arrested anybody until last year. And they charged a man named Edward Holly in her murder. He was her former boyfriend. It's been a really complicated case because the police allege that Holly did not act alone, but they have not charged anybody else in this murder. We believe that's because somebody who was a prior person of interest has since passed away. And there have been a series of pretrial hearings to determine if taped statements that Holly gave to police on five different occasions between 2003 and 2023 would be admissible as evidence. So these were times when he was brought in for questioning, usually not related to the Megan McDonald murder, but police would end up asking him things about the murder, you know, after they were done interrogating him for like a speeding ticket or whatever. Because, you know, he's long been a suspect or at least a person of interest in the case. The case is going to go to trial. Holly and his attorney maintain their innocence, and it doesn't sound like they're working toward any kind of plea agreement or anything like that. There's quite a lot of antipathy between the attorneys on both sides of this issue. And the trial was originally scheduled for January, but it has been pushed back to March 3rd, basically to give a little bit more time for these pretrial hearings to play out. They're taking longer than I think anybody anticipated.
Okay. Well, thank you for that update. And now we can talk about the drones, of which I've heard so much on the TV as I walk past it. I'm not often in front of it. So can you tell me what's up with these drones, the drones that are up in the air?
Well, I can give you the official designation from the federal government, and you can see how much you believe it. So, you know, for anybody who isn't aware, you know, for about a month now, I guess, there have been reports of drones or other kind of unidentified aircraft flying above New England. And last week, a bunch of reports started cropping up in the Hudson Valley, and then they spread to the broader Northeast. At the time, officials did not know what these aircraft were, but they have this week issued a joint statement from the FBI, Federal Aviation Administration, Defense Department, and the Department of Homeland Security, saying that the drone sightings that have been reported in recent weeks do not present any threat and are a combination of lawful commercial, hobbyist, and police drones, as well as fixed-wing aircraft, helicopters, and even STARS that some people are, I guess, mistaking for drones. They said, quote, "We have not identified anything anomalous and do not assess the activity to date to present a national security or public safety risk over the civilian airspace in New Jersey or other states in the Northeast."
Okay, and this story is one that I heard about first from someone who, you know, watches a lot of news on TV, and the way they described it to me was like, oh my goodness, they're seeing all these drones. And I pictured like a swarm of them. Like sometimes there's organized swarms of drones. That's what I was picturing. I thought maybe it's just a drone flash mob. By the time I was finally seeing reports about it, you know, popping up on my social media feeds and little videos that people were taking, like, I didn't see a single video where I could tell from this snapshot whether I'm looking at a drone or a plane. Now, when you're actually there in person, you can hear it and see it more clearly. That might be something else. But is there a chance that this is something that's less about what people are seeing and more about what people are hearing about in certain corners of the web and TV news and then going out and looking for it?
I would say there's a very strong chance that that's the case. Yeah, I've seen a lot of these photos and videos as well. And, you know, some of them are kind of mysterious and weird. But, like, you know, the FBI said that they have received more than 5,000 reports of drone sightings or alleged drone sightings in just the last few weeks. And, you know, as I said, some of those seem to be actual drones, if not, you know, mysterious drones from another planet. But a lot of them are just like STARS or helicopters or clearly planes or whatever. And some of the videos I've seen, it's like, okay, this thing is moving like a plane. Maybe you can't see its wings because it's dark, but it's probably just a plane. And so, you know, things like this kind of broke through, you know, into public consciousness and then almost became like memeified. And I think that people were certainly, you know, looking for, or perhaps more credulous of some kind of outsider or mysterious explanation than there would have been had it not been a big national story.
Absolutely. And I think also this, to me, this is where I'm going to get on my soapbox and I'll get opinionated in the news. But I think this also is what comes from people not checking out the night sky enough. You know, I think if you check out the night sky more, you'll be amazed. There's so many man-made and truly extraterrestrial things out in the space that you can see at night when the weather's good. So as Jack, the late Jack Horkheimer of the Miami Transit Planetarium, and our own Keith Hubbard on Farm and Country Star Talk, both were famous for saying, keep looking up when you're out there at night, because you need to know your night sky now more than ever.
Absolutely. Co-sign that.
There you go. I got on my soapbox. I get back down now because we have one last really cool story. And I'd heard this in passing on the NPR headlines this morning, and then I had to hear another headline before I realized this is a Hudson Valley story. But people dug up a mammoth. Is that anywhere close to the truth?
A mastodon, which I was doing a lot of prehistoric elephantine research earlier this week, and there was actually quite a big difference allegedly between mammoths and mastodons. But and this also goes to the point, I think, of noticing the environment around you. A couple of homeowners in Scotchtown, a hamlet in Orange County, found in their backyard fossilized mastodon teeth. And they did a little bit of digging and realized there might be more there. And so they called in researchers, which led to what scientists are calling a remarkable discovery. Several fossilized mastodon bones, including a complete adult jaw. They carbon dated these and estimate them to be about 13,000 years old. And they are the first mastodon fossils discovered in the state of New York in 11 years.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Do we know what's going to happen with these academically, like who's involved in investigating it and where this might be going?
Yeah, so the researchers who came in were from SUNY Orange and the New York State Museum up in Albany on Empire Plaza there. The State Museum has a mastodon exhibit already because the mastodon, which was endemic to the landmass that's now North America, seems to like this area. You know, I mentioned it had been 11 years since any mastodon fossils were found in the state of New York, but the first mastodon fossils found in North America were found in Claverack, and there have been more than 100 fossils found across the state to date over the 300 or so years that we've been digging. And about a third of those apparently have been unearthed in Orange County specifically, which the state called, I thought this was funny, quote, the premier hotspot for these ancient relatives of modern elephants. So I guess they really liked Orange County.
That's it. Orange County was a hot place to be, whatever it is, in millennia. 13,000 years ago. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Sometime next year, apparently these remains will be on display at the State Museum in Albany for the public. But it can't wait that long. There's the aforementioned mastodon exhibit that's already there. And, SUNY Orange also has a mastodon skeleton at the main entrance of its biotech building. This is a skeleton that was, found in 1972 nearby and is referred to as the Sugarloaf mastodon.
Philip Pantuso, Times Union. I'll remind people all these stories are up at timesunion.com. And I want to thank you so much for going over all this with us. Thank you.
You got it. Take care.
Well, good evening, people. You've heard the heavy stories, and now it's time for evening message tree missives. We're going to take a quick break when we come back. What is next for the late historic message tree at the original Woodstock site? It's a new day, believe it. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
What we ended up seeing in 2024 was a coalition of crypto companies working together really closely and really strategically to pour a huge, you know, honestly unprecedented amount of money into politics.
I'm Sabrina Tavernisi. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
every week on City Arts and Lectures. We bring you conversations with today's most important writers, scientists, performing artists, and cultural figures from around the world. Recorded on stage in San Francisco, talking about creativity, how we see the world we live in, and where we're headed. Join us for City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoons at 4, starting January 5th on Radio Catskill.
It's the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dolb. And you probably know Bethel Woods Center for the Arts is the historic site of the 1969 Music and Art Festival that we call Woodstock. And they are asking artists and artisans to create commemorative works of art in honor of the legendary message tree, a central symbol of Woodstock. The message tree was a 60-foot red maple right on the corner of Heard and West Shore Roads on the historic festival site. And it served as a unique gathering place for festival attendees in 1969, who left messages, notes, and well wishes pinned to its bark, marking it as an enduring symbol of peace, love, and community. Dr. Neil Hitch, the senior curator at Bethel Woods, was back here in our studios this morning to tell Tim Bruno about the message tree and what Bethel Woods hopes to do with it. He starts off explaining what the tree was and what led to its removal.
Well, the message tree is an iconic part of Woodstock. It just sat at the corner of West Shore and Heard. Really, it sat for more than 100 years at within these four farm fields. But at the festival, it just was, you could see it from everywhere. So it became the point of communication where people could gather. People could, you know, put messages on it and say, hey, I need a ride back home. And so we've known since probably around 2017 that the tree wasn't healthy and its time was limited. And, this year it just hit the point where safety and other concerns, it had to come down. So mm-hmm. It came down in September, but we really, you know, we don't want to take it like it was very emotional, let's say, right? A very hard decision. And then you're like, what are the next steps? And at this, you know, the next steps are let's figure out what can be done. But it became apparent, like, let's see really what could be done. And, so this call for proposal is about projects that really would honor the idea of the message tree, honor the idea of Woodstock, the idea of the Woodstock Nation, which is, you know, aging but with lots of memories, and honor the idea of what comes next.
And yeah, I mentioned in the introduction, it became this symbol that defined the Woodstock experience, peace, love, unity. So in this request for proposals, what are the key elements that you're looking for? Is it that idea? And what are the types of art that you're looking for? Is it kind of open to everyone?
Well, it is open to everyone because we don't know what we're looking for, and we're looking for something really special, right? We're looking for something that carries on the message of peace, or that is really, represents a bigger idea. And so it will be interesting to see what comes in. I will say, like, at the beginning, you know, in September, there's one idea, but immediately as we began talking to people and getting, like, people passing off ideas and things, we were like, oh, there may be some interesting things here. We are in the process now of, you know, we will evaluate the proposals that come in. We're looking for something really different, I gotta say. And this isn't a process that's going to be overnight. It's a process that's going to take some time. And then we're going to work with selected artists to see how they would need the physical wood of the tree processed to do their art. So that there may be a link there as well.
So the wood from the tree that was taken down still exists, and folks can utilize part of that?
Well, I mean, that's the idea is using the wood from the tree. I'll tell you, we did a test with a very small piece because you're concerned. It's a rotted tree, and we didn't know what
it
was going
to
be.
Use too much.
It is maple, and the one piece that was kind of a cut and tested is very nice maple. So we're hoping that when the tree is processed, which is kind of an ugly word, sorry, that we'll have some nice things. Yeah. And we're not sure what that looks like yet. The drying time is going to be lengthy. And again, it is sitting in a raw form waiting for proposals, and then we'll decide what happens next.
Are there specific guidelines for artists about how they can work with this wood, given the historical importance of it, and also given the condition?
I don't know that there's any guidelines. There's, you know, we have pieces that basically will be milled as lumber, so it will be a nice grade, whether that's small projects or big projects.
So you want to see what comes, and the idea is that to display these final works in the museum in the Arts and Crafts of Woodstock exhibit.
I think that was an idea, but again, you have to see what comes in. What we don't want is someone thinking what we're looking for is a museum piece, and they are going to present that, and it's going to hang in a museum.
So it could be something site-specific even. Like, it could be where the original tree may have been, or I think that open to a lot of ideas.
We're open to ideas. What we're looking for is ideas. Okay. Like, what we wanted to do is not make it, like, say, this is what we're going to do with it, because what the tree stands for is such a larger idea than and it existed long before Bethel Woods. And so immediately, like, just talking to colleagues, we were like, this isn't a decision that, one, will take lightly, and two, that I personally think is up to us. I really want to put this out there to a greater good and really have people think hard, like, about what comes next with the message of Woodstock. What do we leave for the generations that didn't experience the 60s? And how do we create something that is so meaningful that it will leave its own mark for people who aren't even born?
And in the meantime, you're still out there trying to preserve those memories. The oral history project continues. You're traveling to Florida this January in a unique collaboration with the Borscht Belt Museum. Tell us about that.
So we are entering our fifth year of the Oral History Initiative.
Yeah.
This year is fantastic. We have a great partnership with the Borscht Belt Museum, which is in Ellenville. And what we're doing is we really are looking for local stories, right? Stories of the Catskills. Stories of people who were at resorts, maybe, you know. Now, you know, the Borscht Belt Museum is looking at this larger picture, right, of everything. We're the Museum at Bethel Woods kind of looking at the 60s, but these things cross paths. Mm-hmm. We hear all the time about how the people of this community came together to support Woodstock, as, you know, whether it's a disaster or feeding kids or caring for people, caring and sharing, right? And we want those stories. Here's the funny thing. There's an awful lot of people that experienced the Catskills in the 60s who are now living in Florida. So we are doing the first pop-up this year, these pop-up oral history. They take place where we'll go to a location, and then people will come, and we do about an hour-long interview on camera. And that will happen in Boca Raton, January 19th through the 23rd this year.
So if somebody's listening and wants to get involved, they can go to the website and find out more information.
They can. They can go to the BethelWoodsCenter.org website, go to the museum, and there's a whole space there. You could also email oralhistory@BethelWoodsCenter.org.
And you don't just have to live in Florida for this one. You do for that pop up, but you're looking for these stories. You're still looking. 5 years later, you're still trying to accumulate that goal.
We'll be doing a series of oral history pop-ups at the museum, at the Borscht Belt Museum in Ellenville. We'll also be doing some pop-ups at the museum at Bethel Woods. And we also, almost every day now, somebody comes in and is interviewed at the museum.
Oh, that's great.
In Bethel.
Oh, that's great. Great. So what's the goal again? You're trying to preserve how many voices?
Well,
stories?
There's a couple of goals, right? We'd love 1%, 4,500. Mm-hmm. In what we call these long form oral histories, in the 5 years, we had a goal of 1,200. We are going to hit that this year.
Oh, great. Congratulations. Yeah. That's great. And folks can get more information about the Oral History Project and this RFP for the message tree, and transforming that into a legacy for generations to come at BethelWoodsCenter.org. We've been talking to Dr. Neil Hitch, Senior Curator at Museum at Bethel Woods. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Love being here.
Happy holidays.
Thank you, Tim Bruno. Thank you, Dr. Hitch. And that's going to do it for the Local Edition. I've been your host, Jason Dole. Stay with us. We've got Ramble Tamble coming up at 7, but first, it's The Daily This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The DeBruce in Livingston Manor, New York, an award-winning restaurant and internationally recognized hotel overlooking the Willowemic Valley. TheDeBruce.com. From The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners.